Friends, welcome. Today we have the distinguished honor to welcome in our midst James Proud, author of John Woolman and the Affairs of Truth, which he will be sharing some of his process in creating that book, editing those materials with us today. I wanted to do a couple of technological announcements at the beginning. First, please turn off your mobile phones if you have one of those on you. Second, this is going to be a recorded event. And so for the sake of creating the best quality recording, when it comes time for question and answers, we ask if you have a question to stand, wait for a second, and then state your question. And you might notice a boom over top of your head to pick up on your voice. Just carry on as usual as you can. And the microphone will pick up your question. We just need to wait for a few seconds so that it can get in place. So with that, James Proud, the editor of John Woolman and the Affairs of Truth, is an attorney, now retired, a priest of the Episcopal Church. He previously published an article, A Note on John Woolman's Paternal Ancestors in Quaker History in 2007. Would you join me in welcoming James Proud?
Thank you very much. I find it a great honor and privilege to be with you tonight. And I'm very grateful for the help that Betty Haglund made months ago in arranging my time here, because I said that I would be doing some other research in England. And this was an occasion to be with you and to have also the very great privilege of being in a company this size sharing an interest in John Woolman. I've had that happen to me only once in the States before, and to find so many people who have an affinity for the man, his mission, his writings is a real treat. I'm grateful to John Kirshner for presiding tonight, and I had a long email correspondence with John 3 years ago when he was here about the time for his first summer, and today I met him for the first time, so that is a delight as well. As you heard, I am not a Quaker, though I am fully persuaded by Quaker practices and beliefs and testimonies. I am an Episcopal priest, so I come from a steeple house. I hope you will forgive me that. I am not a hireling priest because I earn my living as an attorney, and I serve mostly in marginal parishes in New York City and in Philadelphia. So I sort of share that aspect of being in the practical world and being in ministry with Woolman, and I think that's another part of the affinity that I feel with the man. I am grateful for the privilege of being asked to be with you today as we honor the memory and reflect on the legacy of John Woolman, a Christian prophet for his own time as well as for ours. 8 years from now, on 19 October 2020, the Religious Society of Friends Worldwide will observe the 300th anniversary of his birth. And 10 years beyond that date, on 7 October 2022, it will observe the 250th anniversary of his untimely death. I mention these two important occasions in the near future as reminders of how venerable is John Woolman's prophetic legacy to humanity, how relevant and fresh sounding his legacy still is, and how urgent is our present need to understand and embrace his teachings concerning the affairs of truth. The leading question is, who was this man? a very common public perception in decades before our time, and I suspect in many quarters of society where the name is even known, it still persists. And it was epitomized in John Greenleaf Whittier's introduction to the 1872 edition of the Journal, in which he is commenting on moral reform in the context of anti-slavery. And he begins his take on Woolman on the very first page of his introduction. He says that these reforms often occur through, quotes, some comparatively obscure individual. And advancing his own theme on the second page, he writes, I still quote, undoing the evil work of centuries unquestionably owes much of its original impulse to the life and labors of a poor, unlearned working man of New Jersey. And even advancing the argument from there at the bottom of page 2 and at the top of page 3, he quotes from the diary of Henry Crabb Robinson, who he notes is the intimate friend of Goethe, Wordsworth, and Coleridge, who described Woolman as an illiterate tailor. He writes in a style of the most exquisite purity and grace. That's not the John Woolman of history. That's not the John Woolman of his writings. It's not the John Woolman of his journal. All of us, I am sure, come to our personal search for and interest in Woolman by a different path, a unique perspective. My own search began almost 20 years ago from a simple, everyday interest in genealogy. And I would like to, as modestly as I can, explain a rather unusual relationship with the man. As you may know, Woolman was the oldest of seven sons. He had six sisters as well. It was a large family. It was living on a plantation. His father was born in New Jersey, but his father and the father before that had come over from England in the 1670s. So John Woolman is second generation. They're working the land. And when he decided that he didn't want to inherit the position of his father and become the patriarch in his own generation, he explained that to his father. At the age of 21, he left the family, he left the plantation, moved several miles away into Mount Holly, apprenticed himself to the owner of a store, and he left behind his six brothers, all of whom had Old Testament names. The oldest who succeeded him as patriarch was named Abner. The next to the youngest who remained behind was Abraham. Abner's daughter and Abraham's son fell in love with each other, and they eloped on first day meeting time. In consequence, she was disowned. Not too long after that, they relocated out to the Midwest, into Indiana and Ohio, where my father's family settled. Their child would be a great niece of John Woolman, was the maternal grandmother of my paternal grandfather. Don't struggle to figure it all out, but I come from a rather strange union for which, if I didn't mention it, she was disowned by her meeting, but he was not. That's how I connect with John Woolman, and I thought this is an opportunity to get back into ancient family history. And the more I read about Woolman, the more I was drawn into his world as to his ethos, his biblical theology. His understanding of the life and times in colonial America. Then the search became more serious. The John Woolman Memorial Association in Mount Holly, New Jersey, in a house that Woolman probably built for his daughter and her husband as a wedding gift, has maintained an existence on those premises for most of the last 100 years. And they have published a genealogy of the John Woolman family. And I was trying to get back before the journalist generation, and there were some helpful guides that the grandfather, who was also named John, and his father, William, had come from Gloucestershire. Checking the public record office records, I was able to find them in the parish of Tainton, which is about 7 miles to the west of the city of Gloucester, on the verge of the Forest of Dean. And William, the great-grandfather, is recorded there as having been born 1632. It's about 8 years after George Fox. And John, his son, was born there in 1655. No other written records about Woolman, but there are no other Woolmans in any other parish registers that I could find. The next time the name appears in any record is when John Woolman, not spelled the way we have it now, but W-O-L-L-M-A-N, appears as a witness at 2 Quaker weddings held a year apart in Painswick, about 3 miles to the east of Gloucester. And John Woolman is a witness at each of those. The next record is a year later in 1677, when John Woolman, this time with 2 O's and 2 L's, purchases a small fractional interest, 1/32nd proprietary interest, in one of the 90 shares that William Penn was marketing in what is now called West New Jersey. Penn had been appointed as an arbitrator to resolve a dispute between 2 Quakers in London, one of them probably acting as agent for the other, but they had a falling out because of the insolvency of the principal and the chicanery of the agent as to who had what share in this land that had been purchased from one of the retainers of Charles II, and a land grant had been made after the Restoration, and he had sold it to these 2 Quakers. Well, Penn and 2 others stayed on once they resolved the dispute as trustees to sell the property, and this John Woolman, the grandfather, purchased a 1/32nd interest in 1 of 90 shares, a rather small amount, but he and his father then came across to the New World, and they were certainly here by 1679, and they were settled in Burlington, and they acquired land along the Rancocas River. The father and son had a falling out. It's not clear whose money was used to make the purchase, but it is surprising that the concessions and agreement that Penn had written with the other trustees, determining what the governance and the distribution of land and the frontage of the land on navigable waters and a lot in the city of Burlington itself, all the proprietors signed these concessions and agreements. No one named Woolman signed, which seemed to me very odd. There are a number of perplexities in this history. There was, however, well, there were a few people who marked with X's. William, it seems, was illiterate, couldn't read or write, couldn't write his name. And there is an X, and somebody has written in the names that they heard and thought might be correct. And the name given there was Wooly O. Woolison, which could very well be William Woolman. As a record of the sufferings that they might have gone through in Gloucestershire before leaving for America, there is no William Woolman listed in. You can clarify this. I've never been sure. Is it Bessa? Bess or Bessie?
I don't know.
Let's say Bess. In Bess's account of the collection of all of the sufferings of the people in Scorn called Quakers, while there is no Woolman listed, there is, however, a William Wooly, typically imprisoned and fined for not paying steeple house taxes, not paying tithes, attending meetings in violation of the laws at that time. Also, there's no record of who William's wife was or the mother of John Woolman. By the time they were over here, the father and son had a falling out. There was some litigation between them, and the title had been taken in John's name, and he transferred 100, 150 acres to William, who then moved in with a neighboring family and left that property to the neighboring family at his death. That's the extent of the official record of who John Woolman's forebears were. Then I began searching for him in his journal, and he has no comments at all about his forebears. For those of you who have read it carefully, you will see that he has very few references and doesn't name only but a few of his immediate family. Talks about his father several times. He names him once. Talks about his mother several times. Doesn't name her at all. The six brothers, all with Old Testament names. No mention whatsoever. He had six sisters. Five of them he mentioned not at all. The eldest, Elizabeth Junior, she was called, is mentioned five times. He mentions his wife by name only once, and that's in the year that they were married. He mentions his daughter Mary, not at all. And he makes no mention or comment or observation at all about the birth and death of his son William, who died at the age of 2 months in 1754, which is probably one of the most important years in Woolman's early life. The grief that he would have felt, the psychological burden that might have caused, how this worked out in his life, what he did with his life, none of that is explained. What is especially revealing, however, is that 2 months before the death of this child, other friends in the area also lost a son. And Woolman immediately poured out, and I will read it so you get a flavor of his language, other than that is found in the journal. He poured out his heart and really empathized with the grief that he thought they were going through. Of his own, he could say nothing. To friends, he wrote, "Your dwelling, where the voice of joy and prayer has been heard, and the candle of the Lord shined bright now sits in solitary mourning. But let us ascribe righteousness to our Maker, even when clouds and thick darkness are around about him. He who gives has a right to take away, and we ought in humility to bless his holy name. Blessed be God that you are not of the number of those who mourn without hope. Your child, though parted from you for a season, you may, I believe, justly, hope to meet hereafter in the shining realms of paradise, where there is no more death, sorrow, nor crying, nor any more pain, where fathers shall not hope in vain, nor mothers bring forth in trouble. Those who inhabit there are the blessed of the Lord, and their offspring with them. I make no doubt but that in the day of your adversity, the world and the glories of it appear more empty and vain than they were wont to do in time of prosperity. And probably God may sometimes take away our dearest enjoyments on earth to wean us from too fond a love of created enjoyments and to teach us to place our highest felicity, content, and satisfaction in himself, who is a never-failing portion of happiness to all that sincerely trust in him. May God sanctify this heavy dispensation of his providence to you and yours for this happy end, and while the streams of worldly comforts fail, may you be effectually satiated and refreshed with the pure water of the river of life. And of his own grief, he could say nothing. Having found so little in the journal, I then turned to search for his other general or public writings. But where were those lifetime writings? What were they? Where? When? Why? And why was no collection available? Moulton has three major essays in his important work of the 1970s, the two essays on Considerations on Keeping Negroes and the Plea for the Poor. He also incorporates in the text of the journal, as the editors of the journal did when it was immediately prepared after Woolman's death, the two peace epistles in 1955 and 59 that issued from the Philadelphia Quarterly Meeting for Ministers and then Philadelphia Yearly Meeting itself, and that wonderful pastoral epistle that he wrote 1757 to the two meetings in Western North Carolina, Cane Creek. But that was about it. There were hints there. And so I set about to gather them all up, the known and the unknown, and to put them in chronological order, in order better to see the architecture of the man's adult life. He began his ministry when he was recognized as a minister by Burlington Monthly Meeting in 1743, and in the next year or two set up for business on his own in Mount Holly when his employer closed his shop. By this time, he knew how to keep a store with general merchandise and goods. He had learned some tailoring from another employee of his employer. And so he thought that regularly attending meeting for worship, meetings for business, both in Mount Holly and in Burlington, and with the ministers and with Philadelphia Yearly Meeting, he would be able to support a very small family, his wife, his daughter, and himself, and to be able to travel in ministry. And then the sequence of his writings was puzzling. He made his first major journey. It was into the South, and it was the occasion in 1746 for writing the first major essay, the Considerations on Keeping Negroes, Part One. And he sat on it for 8 years. I'll come back to that point. For the longest time, I thought maybe it was the author's fright at releasing his first work, a shyness, a modesty, a humility, which is certainly germane to his character. And nothing much happened after that until it was published in 1754. We'll come back to that. And then immediately much else just was released and flowed forth. In 1754, not only was Considerations on the Keeping of Negroes published by Philadelphia Yearly Meeting, but the French and Indian War was breaking out. Philadelphia Yearly Meeting that same year issued its Epistle of Caution and Advice, warning against the buying and selling of Negro slaves. Then came his second trip into the South, and he published almost immediately after that the second epistle on Considerations on Keeping Negroes, Part Two. And he had also, during this time, made two major journeys into New England. He went twice into the South, into the Deep South, and he pours out his heart in the journal on what he felt and saw, and this evil that was spreading in the burgeoning colonies, and what he thought it portended for the future. And twice he went up into New England and found the same thing there, especially in Newport. And all of that informed the second consideration of Negroes. And then in 1763, he made the last of his major American journeys. It wasn't as far, but it was much more dangerous. He went to the northwestern Pennsylvania frontier, to a place called Wyalusing, and it was a time that there were massacres by Native Americans of English settlers in that area. And though he was fearful, and a companion insisted on joining him to be with him during this ordeal, he set out there and came back and almost immediately thereafter wrote the last of the major epistles on his American journeys, which in Woolman is called A Plea for the Poor, and in the new edited volume, a text that only became available as Moulton was being set in print, a more cohesive, integrated version of that, which wasn't called A Plea for the Poor, was called something about a word of remembrance to the rich. And in it there is a chapter, and he made chapters for one of the very few times that he did, reflecting on what had happened to the Native Americans in this land, how their patrimony had been lost for very little coinage. Many of them had discovered the evils of alcohol. The choice fishing grounds had been lost. The choice hunting grounds had been lost. And rather than address solely the issue of what had been done to the Native Americans, he broadened it into this more comprehensive, philosophically deeper study of the growing inequality in America and the pursuit of wealth with a consequent effect upon those who were being impoverished by those who had more than they needed and were content to rely on the labor of those less fortunate and live lives of ease and pass all of this on to their own progeny. After that, his active searching journeys in America were mostly over. He made fewer trips in the New Jersey, Pennsylvania area. He, in three successive years, went walking in Maryland. And during this time, as his daughter was getting older, no doubt, he attended to teaching school, and for that purpose wrote a children's primer, at least in three editions. No copies are now in existence, except for one copy of the third edition that's held at Friends House Library in London. He had also, and I'll come to that later, served on a committee in the 1750s to make the one and only, I think, revision of the queries which had been adopted in Philadelphia Yearly Meeting and then sent out to all of the monthly meetings. So he was deep into the problems of the discipline and the ethics of the Society of Friends, maintaining good morals, sound marriages, concern for the education of children. And so during this period, he first wrote addressing those moral and ethical topics, considerations on the pure harmony, which is a take on a quote from the Epistle of James, that wisdom which is pure is from above, so he calls this pure wisdom. And there was a companion piece to that which was not published in his lifetime. The overseers of the press didn't approve of it, and one can imagine why. That was called Considerations on Trade. It was pertinent in his day. It's pertinent in ours. As many of the wealthy Quakers in Philadelphia were making their wealth in international trade. They would charter or they would own their own ships and send their crews with a supercargo out, and they would trade in regular routes worldwide. So they were encouraging international trade. Woman's piece on trade probably did not get their favor, and since a number of them were on the overseers of the press committee, they discouraged it being published, and it wasn't published. His point was that you have to secure the viability of the local economy before you start trading with the rest of the world, and before you turn over the local economy to the wealthy. And as we've seen many times with factory cities being emptied when the chief employer moves out of town, the town folds up. That was Woolman's concern. That was his observation back in the 1760s. That was followed by another pair of essays on these moral and ethical dilemmas, considerations on the true harmony of mankind. And then because it was a new genre, he had a follow-up to that called Conversations on the True Harmony of Mankind, and that first seems to be a misprint or a misunderstanding. But what he has done is he has two of these. One is a laboring man's dialogue with a wealthy landowner, and the other is a laboring man's dialogue with a wealthy merchant, something like that. Woolman obviously is the laboring man. He has cast himself in that role. That's the role he chose to live in life. He could have been the patriarch of his generation. He could have succeeded and taken the principal lands, and they were considerable, that his father had owned. He turned it all over to Asher and the other sons down the line, not all of whom got a very large portion. Woolman chose to go out on his own so he could identify with the laboring man. He knew poverty. He knew what it was to pay what others were paying, high rent. He knew what the cost of wheat was. He knew what the care and burden in winter storms of caring for his own livestock. He planted a grove, an orchard of fruit trees. He sold saplings. He was a merchant. He tailored. He kept record books. He was a very astute man of business. And I think John has seen them. There are in the Historical Society of Pennsylvania his account books. Three have been preserved over that period of time. When he wrote the Conversations, he had made up his mind to go to Europe. And so he wrote the Conversations maybe 3 months before he took ship to England. In that period of time, he wrote the last of his major works on the mainland of America, the so-called Farewell Epistle, which he was writing to the gathered church, probably intended for those monthly meetings under the aegis of Philadelphia, yearly meeting. But the overseers of the press decided, since he had been in virtually all of the other provinces of the Society of Friends in America, they sent it out to all meetings. And it was his take on the state of the American church, how it needed to reform itself. He called it the gathered church, and what Christ would want for it. So then he set out on the trip to England. We still don't know that much about him. And I think at this point, it becomes a question of what was Woolman searching for when he went to England in 1772. He'd had that mad rush of writing. He turned over his account book to his son-in-law to maintain his family. He made his will out, leaving everything to his wife. But he made the executor of the will his son-in-law's father, a close friend, who himself was not well and barely survived Woolman, but in the meantime had made disposition to settle the estate in his own will on the daughter and her husband, and to provide for Woolman's family. Why was he going? What was he looking for? He doesn't say. And it was a strange time to go. He had been there for the happy event of the marriage of his only child. She had married John Comfort within the year of Woolman's departure. A cousin to whom he was close, William Harvey, died of smallpox in England, I believe, maybe a year before, and he was hurt by that death. Maybe most importantly, the brother that he was closest to, who was not well, had trouble supporting his family. Woolman had educated two of his four children, one the son who was named John Abramson Woolman, what was known as John Woolman Jr., and it's very confusing as you come across this correspondence because you think this is the journalist's son, who was William and who died. It's a nephew that he felt very attached to. Abner died months before Woolman departed. And another major writing task that he undertook was to write a memorial about Abner's life to the Meeting for Sufferings of Philadelphia Yearly Meeting. He enclosed two very short texts that Abner had written that compared to Woolman's style and vocabulary are rather crude. And then he labored over copying out by hand an extensive document which was Abner's testament to his children, which was really Abner's relating the details of his life and the sufferings that he had gone through. And though it's not mentioned in there, when their father, Samuel, died, Abner is the only one that was sort of omitted from any benefit under the will. And John had made up for that in his lifetime when a younger brother had predeceased all of them. And as John would have inherited that deceased younger brother's share, he wrote an agreement. He wrote legal documents. Part of his work in that shop had been to write deeds and indentures, as you know. So I think he self-taught himself to be a lawyer. Another way I can relate to him. But John had written out this agreement among the surviving brothers that that portion that would have come out of this younger brother's estate, John renounced and was sharing with his was giving to Abner. All of them signed off, and what John would have received, Abner got. So John was in effect making up for this problem with their father. Anyway, the testament that Abner left for his children, very autobiographical, as I suggest in The Affairs of Truth, it's the last of the appendices. I would judge, it's all in the hand of John. He was maybe writing from scraps and pieces of paper. And I suspect that he edited very heavily and in places probably wrote it himself. And there's a suspicion that he did it because in one of the latter pages, there's a marginal comment that John has written. These were the actual words of Abner, which suggests that maybe some of the others, maybe quite a lot of the other, may not have been. Those griefs, apart from the happiness of the marriage of his daughter, the death of Abner especially, the death of Harvey also, hardly seem enough to drive a man to leave his country for this mission, especially when in the time that he left, I think while he was at sea or maybe in London, the first of his grandchildren was born. And in those last ethical writings, the Considerations on the True Harmony of Mankind, I think, there are references to what we owe the next generation. He was aware of this. He had to know, and why he would have left. And I think in time they had about 10 children, but he had departed before even the first was born. My own speculation as to why he left, I think he had seen so much in the early years of his pilgrimage and those important journeys into the South, into New England, to the frontier with the Native Americans. He had seen so much enslavement so much poverty, and he had witnessed the introduction of European wars into Penn's Arcadia of Peace, I suspect his heart was broken. And in many ways, as he expressed in those memorable words, he felt a draft to the north, meaning England, and York seemed like home to him. And at the time of his death, when he was dictating, he may honestly have been expressing that burden, that weight on him in this deathbed prayer, which he asked a friend to record. O Lord my God, the amazing horrors of darkness were gathered around me and covered me all over, and I saw no way to go forth. I felt the depth and extent of the misery of my fellow creatures separated from the divine harmony, and it was heavier than I could bear, and I was crushed down under it. I lifted up my hand and I stretched out my arm, but there was none to help me. I looked around and was amazed in the depths of misery. O Lord. It almost sounds like the cry of dereliction from the cross. To end on a happier note, that lovely pastoral epistle that he wrote to Cane Creek has this closing thought in it. He's concerned about the youth. He's concerned about their remaining on this frontier and advancing the principle of the Society of Friends and remaining in peace and harmony. So I would leave with this quote, which comes from the very end of that epistle. Dwell here, my dear friends, and then in remote and solitary deserts you may find true peace and satisfaction. If the Lord be our God in truth and reality, there is safety for us, for he is a stronghold in the day of trouble and knows them that trust in him.
We have some time for questions, and just as a reminder, if you have a question, please stand, pause, and wait a second for the microphone to come to you, and then speak your question. Any questions?
In brief, did he know his grandchild had been born? As I understand it, when he left for England, he gave directions that no letters were to be sent to him by the Royal Mail because he believed the mail coaches were cruel to boys and to horses. And I got the impression that he never actually heard that his grandchild had been born, which I find unbearably moving. Is there actually evidence that he knew the grandchild had been born?
I know of no documentary evidence, but he left Chester, Pennsylvania, on May 1, and the grandchild was born in the month of June, and I have never come across any indication that it was premature.
Yes, Joanna.
How well was John Woolman known among Quakers at a later date? I mean, I'm thinking particularly of British Quakers in the early 20th century.
Wasn't it Charles Lamb who wrote, if you read any American author, read John Woolman and get him by heart. And I can't imagine that the Whittier 1872 edition would not have had wide circulation in Britain. I don't think he's ever been out of the consciousness of American Quakers in their meetings. I think he's a hallowed figure over there. Maybe more often held up as an ideal to be reverenced without being informed by in the way of reading his writings. The journal, yes, but the other writings have, in their whole scope, been so scattered and hither and thither that it hasn't really been possible for most people, anyway, to have access to the libraries where those rare earlier printings of some of these obscure things would be found. But I didn't get to, but it's in the book. He wrote a number of the epistles on behalf of Philadelphia Yearly Meeting, and though the authorship wasn't identified in his time and as they were read and reread and used thereafter, I think his message was getting out.
I have a question. One of the unique things that you do in this book is you put his lesser-known writings in chronological order. And I just wondered, and that's the first time it's been done like that, and I wonder what new discoveries you make on who Woolman is, as opposed to maybe previous conceptions of Woolman, based on his lesser-known writings in this chronological order, which I think bears a greater sense of historicity to it.
A major piece that I left out of the presentation, we didn't have time, was the mystery of why the first part of Considerations on the Keeping of Negroes was 8 years in delay before it got published. And another part of the search, and I hope it answers your question, is when I couldn't find him in all these other places that I've described, and I was coming across these references to the overseers of the press, and I can understand why people in this day and age may not want to talk about censorship. I turned to first finding out who the overseers of the press were, and then I was driven to look year by year by year to the minutes of Philadelphia Yearly Meeting. And hopefully this answers John's question. Woolman first attended as a representative from Burlington Monthly Meeting, Philadelphia Yearly Meeting, in 1746. By that time, he'd been a recorded minister for maybe 3 years. So he had established himself, and by that time, that was the year he had made, and by the time he went to the meeting, had completed the first southern journey. It's my belief that at that time, he came under the patronage, maybe too strong a word, friendship, certainly, collaboration, collegiality with Israel Pemberton Jr., who in 1750 becomes the clerk, the reforming clerk of Philadelphia Yearly Meeting. And as evidence of the influence that they shared and the advancement that Pemberton was able to give Woolman, beginning in 1746, this is rare for a new kid just off the block, he was appointed to one of the epistle writing committees. And he was appointed every year after that until the last year he was in America, in 1771. So he was given, I would suspect, on the basis maybe Pemberton had seen the writing, but he certainly knew of the journey that Woolman had made. Pemberton recognized in him another reforming spirit. And every year that it was in Pemberton's gift and thereafter, Woolman was appointed to write an epistle. He was appointed to the committee to revise the queries in 1753, and Pemberton himself had sat on the queries committee originally. And most amazingly of all, in 1753, when Pemberton could finally get control of the overseers of the press, who, because there were probably more slave owners on the committee than there were abolitionists, Pemberton was able to reconstitute the balance on the overseers of the press. And in 1753, he began moving abolitionists on. And in 1756, he made the third most important appointment of Woolman to anything, and he appointed Woolman to the overseers of the press. Anthony Benezet was there as well. In the same year, 1756, that Woolman was appointed, Pemberton appointed his two brothers, James and John. One was the Speaker of the Pennsylvania Assembly. The other was a recorded minister. Those became his colleagues. And I think that as Pemberton moved forward with basic reform, and that's really what Woolman was about. We were discussing at lunch, who was John Woolman? How do we think of him? Is he a prophet? Is he an ascetic? Is he a spiritual guide? I suspect he's all of those things. I would suspect also, and I would advocate strongly, that he was a reformer. And that Pemberton, who was, there's only been one biography of Pemberton out, and it was appropriately called King of the Quakers. And in his day, he was a king of the Quakers. He was the king of the Quakers. And he served as clerk of yearly meeting for 10 years, then gave it up. Even before that time, during that time, and until his death, Pemberton was the clerk of the schools committee. He focused on that as a basic reform. So I think in Woolman, Pemberton saw a spokesperson, a gifted writer, a serious prophet, a colleague who could address the issues of war, address the issues of education, address the issues of inequality in society, address the issues of poverty, and certainly address the issue of abolition. And I think that becomes clear as you lay all of this out chronologically.
Thanks.
Other questions? Behind Betty.
Thank you. It's been really, really interesting to hear so much about John Woolman's background. However, for me, there's a big gap. You clearly had quite a lot of trouble. He's a private man, finding out about him. And what I've always wanted to know, what did his wife, what did the people who knew with him and lived beside him, alongside him in America, think about him? Often we find out more about people from what others write about them or say about them than what we might say about ourselves. Have you anything to say about that?
I wish I did. I have no knowledge. I came across no records. It begins with the mystery of who was the mother of his grandfather. Who did William marry? Who bore the first John Woolman? He was close to his mother. He certainly admired her. About his wife, he says nothing. I've had that question before. And in a day of our consciences having been raised so considerably on the role of the equality of women in our civil society. And it's surprising that since the Friends recognized the woman's role very early on, there were recorded ministers. Woman went out with several women recorded ministers. Elizabeth Smith of Burlington is an example. Sarah is a cipher. I came across one published bit, and it was in the Quaker collection at Haverford, so it came from a Quaker source. I've never said a word about it, but I'll repeat it because it may give some light. It may be apocryphal, it may or may not be true. And we all know from our own experiences the stresses and strains when spouses travel on business or on missions or whatever it may be. That of a certain morning, he had not told her that he was off on another mission. And before the sun was up, he was out the door so as not to be seen and not to take the consequences. Now, I can imagine a scene like that. I'm sorry I can't address it because even the role of his daughter is minimized. I can say that the daughter, Mary, and her husband, John Comfort, much credit to him. He was a farmer in Bucks County and the oldest of a number of sons, but he left his father's farm to come live with his wife in Mount Holly and to keep a home there until John Woolman's widow died. Only then did they return to Bucks County. So to him, high marks, to Mary for staying on to care for her mother. The women in John Woolman's immediate family are unknown. Their history has yet to be written, and I don't know where you would find any documentation about them.
Betty.
This is a question to James, but it might also be a question to John as well. I was struck when you read that deathbed prayer and also the epistle by how psalm-like they were. The cadences were those of the psalms. And I've never actually, I mean, I've read a lot of Woolman. It's never occurred to me to read Woolman out loud, and maybe it should have done. And so what I wondered was how much in his writings have either of you found that sense of, you know, somebody whose own way of writing draws in that way on the cadences of the Old Testament?
Did you hear that? You want to answer it, then I'll answer it.
Okay.
You go first.
Well, Woolman internalized the scriptures, and he quotes this. It's recorded that he quotes the scripture over 700 times, but from what I've seen, most of his use of scripture are in little words and phrases, little allusions that are never really picked up on. So I would gather that the 700 number is probably an underestimation. He knew scriptures in and out. And I do think he internalized what G. Thomas Kausser has called the prophetic mode. And he understood himself as a prophet, including the language and the place in time, and his mission in the world was that of a prophet. That's how he understood himself. And so I think he did weave together scripture and his own language in a way that sounded a lot like scripture. And so it kind of bears that cadence of you know, a time from the past, as he adopted that persona.
I agree with what John has said. I was struck by the fact that he is so biblically literate. Mm-hmm. And while he quotes exactly from the King James Version, On some occasions, he freely paraphrases, even with a citation, in others. But there are an infinite number of phrases that are straight out of the Bible, not in quotation marks throughout. And I think he thought and wrote biblically. Not much other authority is cited. He doesn't cite Fox. Some of the other, who are they, the Valiant 60, mm-hmm. like Dewsbury, they get some citations. But I suspect that thinking and writing biblically, he was living biblically, and he thought that the only authority he needed, other than his own spirit-filled experiences, were probably to be found in the pages of Scripture. One of the tasks I couldn't possibly consider undertaking in the book was doing the index. And Charles Martin found a wonderful indexer. And the question came, should we include the scriptural citations within the general index, which I had never wanted to do, and she did exactly what I hoped would be done, prepared a separate scriptural index, which I think runs to at least 300 citations, including a number from Psalms. I thought I had read earlier or had an understanding that he was really identified with Jeremiah more than any other, but there's as much Isaiah as there is Jeremiah, and he runs the whole gamut of the Old Testament as well as the New Testament. He was very Catholic in his quotations, lowercase c.
We have time for one last question, Carol.
This is kind of a follow-up to Gay's question and also the other question about Scripture. I was curious to know how representative his journal is to other journals of the time. Was it common for journal writers not to really focus much on their family? I know I've read other journals that the writers don't seem to focus on their family or mention them either. And also the way he used Scripture, was that typical of most journal writers, that they had internalized Scripture in the way that Woolman has, or is he a somewhat unusual example of the time?
Since I haven't read many other Quaker journals, I'm not the one to answer that question. I have labored for the last year and come to greatly enjoy George Fox's journal. But I don't think there's, you might be asking the same question about George Fox's journal, too. And it's nothing like Woolman's journal. I would guess each of them are unique, but you have more authority on that than I do.
Yeah, I do sense that there is a standard format, and within that standard format, there's a lot of individualization. But the purpose of the journal was to teach and portray a certain image. And so kind of the family things that might be interesting but are not necessarily part of portraying the vision that Woolman wanted to portray would have been left out. And that's fairly typical in, especially in 18th century Quaker journals. Well, let's give James a round of applause and appreciation for this.